Robin Wright is an American journalist who has reported from over 140 nations, most recently for The Washington Post. Her latest book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, has just been published in paperback. In the second part of an interview originally conducted last week, WMNF asked Wright about Iran. She writes, "Few societies are as complex or as nuanced as Iran, but understanding the diversity within political Islam is understanding its future."
Yes, I think we often lump all people who are Muslim together, or all people who are devout, in one category. And in fact, the diversity within the Islamist spectrum is enormous right now. You have those at one extreme, like Osama bin Laden, but you have those on the other extreme, like the Prime Minister of Turkey and the leading opposition group in Morocco, who don't consider themselves religious as parties, but their parties are based on religious values. And they are working with opposition. They are fully prepared and accept the transition of power so that it's not one man or one party, one rule indefinitely after one democratic election. And I think that we make a mistake in not understanding the array of political forces that have emerged in the region, in some ways that are hopeful, that do want to work with the international community, are prepared to accept Israel's right to exist, and do want to embrace political pluralism and economic openings.
Indeed, one of the chapters that you have in your book that does not get a lot of whole attention in terms of American coverage of the Middle East is Morocco. You write about that. What can you tell our listeners about that Middle Eastern nation that we might find interesting or provocative?
Well, one of the most interesting characters in my book, and I write the whole book in terms of who are the new players and activists, what are their stories, and trying to get people hooked on the subject by introducing these interesting people. And one of the characters in that chapter is about a woman who was born into a harem and who's all the girls in the family, mothers, aunts, grandmothers, and so forth, were all illiterate, and how even the radio was locked behind a cabinet and the key hidden so that the women wouldn't listen to the radio. They were not allowed to leave the house. And there was a little girl who lived in the house who saw where her father hid the key, went in and listened to the radio when her father was out, and learned that about her country, Morocco, and her city, Fez, and about Africa, the continent in which she lived, and about the international world. And she also heard about schools that had opened for girls in Morocco, and she begged her mother to get her father to let her go to school. And she not only ended up in public school, but she then went on to the Sorbonne in Paris and did her PhD at Brandeis University, and she is today the Arab world's leading feminist. So that's change in my lifetime, and that shows how much movement there has been, even though we think of that region as kind of locked into the past.
Well, absolutely, and you do write in your book that it's about disparate experiments with empowerment in the world's most troubled region, and that's an example of seeing some real change there.
Oh, I think so. I think that the number of people, whether they're bloggers or judges or feminists or satellite television station owners who offer a means of circumventing state-controlled television, radio, and print, that there's enormous amount of activity at a lot of different levels. It's not one network. They're not joined up to press for change. It's all kind of neighborhood stuff, but it is a beginning, and I think that is what will define what happens in the region over the next generation more than anything else.
Let me ask, if I could, a personal question. I remember that you used to be at the Los Angeles Times, and now with the Washington Post, you continue to cover these issues in the Middle East. What began that whole journey with you becoming this international reporter covering the Middle East?
Well, I landed by accident in the Middle East the first time on October 6, 1973. And that was the day the Fourth Middle East War broke out. And I'll never forget a tourist at the airport in Beirut leaning over and whispering to me, "The Egyptians have crossed the Suez Canal." And the Middle East, once it gets into your blood, is very difficult to walk away from it. I've spent lots of years in other parts of the world, in Europe and Africa, Asia, Latin America, but I always find myself attracted back to the Middle East. It is the center of international diplomacy and international conflict.
the Iraq War, which will be coming up with our 60-year anniversary next week. And, of course, the news that we did have Friday from the president regarding withdrawal of troops, and it's considered in many ways not this incredible revelation. We did have that Status of Forces Agreement, which was announced last year. Your colleague, or former colleague at the Post, Thomas Ricks, has written in his new book, he disagrees with this whole theory that will be out by the year 2011. He says he doesn't think it will happen until 2015. He thinks that Obama is being maybe naively optimistic, as Bush was throughout many of his pronouncements. What are your comments on that?
Well, the Status of Forces Agreement does have an agreement for the U.S. to leave by 2011, but there is a provision in it that says that it's possible to change it if either side wants it, and they agree on new terms. And depending on how security is in 2011, it's quite clear that the Iraqi government could change its mind. Part of the reason there was such pressure for withdrawal from Baghdad is that Iraq also faces the national elections this year, and to allow U.S. troops to be there, at least on paper, for any longer would be very unpopular politically. So a lot can change, and remember, we're going to have 50,000 troops in Iraq for all of 2011, or for most of 2011, and that's a significant armed force to have on the ground.